From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the deadline's here to reunite immigrant families, but effects of the forced separation could be felt for a long time.
You know, many of these children will have no access to ongoing supportive services to address this, particularly children who've been repatriated abroad.
The Marchione legacy.
Sergio Marchione saved a company in Detroit. And he saved tens of thousands of jobs. He saved a lot of property values in Oakland County.
Superstars of English soccer coming to Ann Arbor. Liverpool versus Manchester United.
You're talking a rivalry that probably goes back something like, I would say, 140 years at least.
And the Yale Bologna Fest.
You can have the best fried bologna sandwiches you've ever had besides what Mama used to make.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The U.S. government is scrambling to meet today's court-ordered deadline to reunite hundreds of children who were separated at the border from their parents. About 50% or so of those families have been reunited, but the government admits hundreds of families separated under President Trump's zero-tolerance policy won't be reunited anytime soon. Susan Reed is back with us. She is supervising attorney for the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center, which legally represents the immigrant children who were brought to our state. Susan, how many children came to Michigan, and how many have been reunited with their parents?
So of a little more than 50 separated children who came to Michigan through the federal foster care programs for unaccompanied children, we have a total of 9 remaining clients who are in Michigan, and they all do have reunification plans or are in situations where reunification is not viable at this time, and there's a couple of different reasons why that could be the case. But as you mentioned, we are the independent legal advocates for all of those children and are working to advance their interests every day going forward.
So we have Michigan at around 90% for reuniting kids with their parents. Nationally, it's only around 50%. Why the difference?
Michigan is different because in Michigan, every child has a legal advocate, which is the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center, our office. And because children are in a therapeutic foster care setting with appropriate staffing through Bethany Christian Services. And Bethany indeed has worked very hard from the day each child has arrived to identify parents, to track parents in detention, and to follow parents who've been released or deported. And that is not the case, from what I can tell, in the large border shelters. It is not the case with every service provider. But I can certainly say that we have worked together very hard on keeping track of parents when the system was not set up to make that easy for us. And we have worked together with the foster care agency toward reunification for our clients.
Susan, of the children who are still here in Michigan, and you said there's several reasons, why are they still in Michigan?
So I can give you a couple of scenarios that exist within the population, again, without speaking about a specific case. One possible scenario is that, for example, a parent has already been deported and is now saying they don't want reunification because they want their child to be able to continue pursuing asylum or another form of relief. All of our clients are in deportation proceedings, but every child's case is different, and so the child may still have a viable asylum claim. Asylum is more and more difficult every day, particularly because there have been decisions that target Central American asylum seekers for exclusion from the asylum process. But truly, from the parent's perspective, the parent may be saying, I cannot provide a life or safety for my child, so do not reunify my child with me here. You know, please continue pursuing safety and freedom for my child, even if it means we will be separated.
Of those 40-some children who were reunited with their families, do we have any idea how many of those reunited families were then deported?
None of the families of our clients who have been reunited in the U.S. have been deported following reunification. All of the families with ongoing immigration cases in the U.S. have been released from custody, which is a great outcome. We have two clients who are detained in family detention in Texas following reunification with their detained parents. Those are the children whose parents had already been ordered removed. And looking at the coercive nature of those parents basically having agreed to their removal orders in most of the cases nationally because they believed they had to get their children back, that is at issue and will continue to be litigated.
You're seeing these children, Susan Reed, as the weeks wear on, between living in this new place, this strange new place of Michigan, and being separated from their parents. How is that affecting them?
It's incredibly traumatic. I had a moment, Cindy, a few weeks ago where I was working very hard under a deadline on a piece of writing, and my colleague, our wonderful legal assistant and program coordinator, Camila Treffs, was meeting with some of our youngest clients. And throughout the day, so many tears were being shed that I had to put in earplugs to finish the work that I was doing for some of our other clients just to get through it. You know, foster parents and mental health professionals through Bethany can tell you that in the day-to-day contact they have with these children, it has been absolutely devastating. And it doesn't end with reunification.
Go ahead. What happens after that? What's your biggest worry for these children?
Well, I mean, obviously, like, the trauma of separation has a lot of potential ongoing psychological consequences, including depression, anxiety, feelings of shame, feelings of abandonment. I'm not a mental health professional, but because we strive to be trauma-informed, you know, trauma is re-experienced, especially trauma that's experienced by a young child. And, you know, many of these children will have no access to ongoing supportive services to address this, particularly children who've been repatriated abroad with parents who were deported or children who are not ultimately granted relief in our immigration system, which, as I mentioned, is certainly a more and more likely outcome as this administration restricts and restricts and restricts legal eligibility for asylum. So we're very concerned for our clients, and we are looking to any resources that they may be available for. Nationally, Lutheran Immigrant and Refugee Services is providing some ongoing services to released families who are in this situation, and that's a step in the right direction.
Susan Reed, Supervising Attorney for the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center. Susan, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you, Cindy.
His impact on the global auto industry cannot be overstated. That's one of the many tributes pouring in for Sergio Marchionne, who died Wednesday. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is the one who wrote those words. Daniel, it is safe to say Chrysler was circling the drain when Marchionne arrived. So exactly how did he save both Fiat and Chrysler from extinction? What were his masterpiece moves?
Well, Fiat, he took over Fiat in 2004, came out of the accountancy and in the insurance business, and was plucked out of that business and brought to Italy by the Agnelli clan that controls Fiat. And in the process of about 4 years, he began to get it gearing and going in the right direction. When the global financial meltdown came, he spied an opportunity. They did not have, Fiat as a group, did not have a major presence in North America. It's a very rich market. It's a truck and SUV market, increasingly so since the time he did that deal. And he saw an opportunity to get his hands on one of the greatest brands. Some people would tell you the greatest American automotive brand in the world, and that's Jeep. And he did that with Ram. And he did it without putting any cash down into the deal. That's what's really important for people to understand. The federal government basically said, here, you take it. You make sure you do this, 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 and this, and this, and meet these conditions.
So basically, it was on the scrap heap.
Yeah. Sergio Marchionne saved a company in Detroit, and he saved tens of thousands of jobs. He saved a lot of property values in Oakland County and a whole lot of other things, because this was a guy who had a certain kind of daring, who was very smart about reading this part of the world. He was educated in Toronto and Windsor. He knew Detroit. He gets Detroit. He gets the grit of it, the history, the kind of people that are here, what makes it tick, what the predilections are of the consumers, a whole host of things. He's a very good leader, put together a very competent and international team. There's 19 people that run that company under what's called the Group Executive Council. With the death of Marchionne and one of his deputies who wanted to be CEO who resigned, there are only two Italians on a 19-member board. There are, by my count, 9 countries that are represented there. You won't find that in any other major car company in the world. I think that's a reflection of kind of his best available athlete strategy when it came to people.
Give us your favorite Marchionne moment, the one that in your mind really sums up who this man was.
Oh, man, there's a lot. I had the experience several times to have meals with him privately. These things would go on for hours. I mean, this was not a perfunctory kind of thing. I mean, you'd go out and have a sit down with him in his office. I bet you I spent 3 hours with him. I had breakfast with him one time in Birmingham. It went on for probably a couple to 3 hours, and the cigarettes come out, if he can do it. I mean, he'd be in his office, and he'd light up cigarettes, and the entire building is a no-smoking zone. One of my favorite stories that I think encapsulates how irreverent he could be, which I loved about the guy, because you know he was saying things that other CEOs wanted to say but were too embarrassed or too timid to say it. So we're at the Detroit Auto Show however many years ago, and Volkswagen says, we're going to build 10 million cars and trucks worldwide within X numbers of years. And I asked him that in the roundtable interview. I said, what do you think of that? And he looked at me and he said, we've seen that movie before. It's called World War II. I mean, there's lots of stories about the guy. Very sharp wit, a very sharp intellect. And if you got him in the right conditions and you were talking off the record, he would be very blunt about people in the industry.
What do you think will change at the top for FCA employees and dealers and suppliers with this new CEO, Mike Manley?
Well, he certainly used the earnings call this week to say more of the same. He'd worked with Sergio for 9 years. He had a lot of respect for him. I understand he's a real hard worker, just like Sergio. Long hours, 80-hour weeks are common. Weekends, he doesn't understand the concept. And, you know, a lot of the performance you've seen from FCA has been driven by what Mike Manley ran, which was North America, Jeep, and Ram. And they are figuring very prominently in the future of the company, as they detailed last month in their 5-year capital markets day in Italy.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, a big sports rivalry that goes back about 140 years comes to the Big House in Ann Arbor this weekend for an historic soccer match.
There will be passion on display, with a capital P, you know, between these two sets of supporters, even the American affiliations.
That is in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Oh, well do I remember when first I went to see.
With that plaintive, lovely song, When First I Went to Sea, singer Katie Els brings us the shared history between Ireland and Michigan's Beaver Island. This song is on Katie's new album that's called Songs from Across the Lake and Sea. It's traditional songs from Ireland, Scotland, and Michigan. Katie Els is with us. Welcome to Stateside, Katie.
Thank you for having me.
So here you are releasing your new CD July 28th. You'll be at the Gaelic League Irish American Club of Detroit, right in Corktown, the spiritual heart of the Irish community, and then, of course, where many Irish immigrants settled when they came to Michigan to flee the famine in the 1840s. I'm wondering how you got to this point, when and how you discovered Irish music.
I discovered Irish music in college. I was studying classical singing, actually. There was an Illan piper who was playing at our school, and he formed an Irish band. And my friend who's playing guitar just said, I think you would sound really good singing these songs. And I have Irish heritage, but just never did anything terribly Irish growing up. And so I thought I'd give it a shot, and I just ended up falling in love with the songs that I was hearing and learning and really gravitated towards it.
And we should let everybody know who heard you say Illan piper and went, say what? The Illan piper is associated with Irish music, and unlike the Scottish Highland bagpipes that you blow through a blowpipe and it's made to call troops into war, the Illan pipe is played with the elbow and has that lovely sound, which, by the way, James Horner used to great effect in Titanic.
Yeah, yeah.
And Braveheart.
Yeah.
So if you've heard those, you've heard the Illan pipes.
Yep.
What spoke to you about this music and about these songs?
At that time, there was a juxtaposition happening for me where with classical music, I was focused really heavily on the technical aspect of singing. But with the Irish music, I just felt like I could relax and emote. I also loved the fact that there was such an honesty to these songs because they were just written to be shared with their community and then passed down from generation to generation. It was just a different kind of creative outlet in terms of singing.
Now, before we talk about the Beaver Island connection and those songs, I want to point out something in your journey to become an Irish singer, and that is the fact that you sing songs on your new album in Irish and do a stunning job of it. Let's take a listen.
The fog and shadow and make a wagon against me. The yach more I can do. For your regal and need them. Cause pay me don't go here, I go here, I go here.
So how did a Michigan girl master singing in a language that goes back to the ancient Celtic peoples from times before the Romans?
Well, the more and more I met singers who are really steeped in the Irish tradition, the more I realized, like, to really be in touch with the older traditional styles, you had to learn Irish. And it was at the Milwaukee Festival, actually, that I met what's called a Shano singer. Shano just literally means old style of singing. And I heard him perform some of these songs from Connemara, two of which I sing on the album. And even though I, at that point, had no idea what he was saying, I was really moved by it. It was almost like he was in like a trance when he was singing, and he really, really pulled you in. I kind of formed a friendship with him, and in talking with him about, you know, how I should go about learning these songs in Irish, he really thought coming over to Ireland and learning the language and just really working with singers over there would be the best. So I was living in Chicago at the time, and I did take some Irish lessons and then ended up moving to Galway and working with another Shano singer, a woman named Nantam Tamin. A lot of these songs, they have older versions of words, or they'll have like really old sayings. So when I'm trying to translate them, it'll be a little bit confusing, but she just kind of helped me understand some of those older words and older sayings as well.
Does it feel different when you're singing in Irish versus singing in English?
I mean, it feels different singing in any sort of a language. It's obviously more active in your brain in a different type of a way.
And you mentioned he was in, when you heard that Shano singer, he was kind of in a trance. There was something that he got into.
Yeah, especially in that style of singing in the Shano songs. It's almost like you kind of remove yourself from the equation. You take it a little bit inward. A lot of times you know, people will close their eyes. They even have a tradition in Shano's where they'll have someone face a corner. It's a very ornamented and improvisatory style that I was learning as well. You're kind of learning the process by which you sing it. It's less performative and more introspective and more internal.
And where's home base for you now?
I'm in Ferndale.
You're in Ferndale. All
and there's
right.
there's a few of us Irish musicians in Ferndale right now.
There actually was quite a tradition at the old White Heather Club of people
getting
together and playing.
Indeed. I was there a couple times,
If you just joined us, I'm speaking with singer Katie Else. Her new album coming out is Songs from Across the Lake and Sea, traditional songs from Ireland, Scotland, and from Michigan, which leads us to the fact that two of the songs on your album are from Beaver Island. The one we heard at the beginning of our conversation, When First I Went to Sea. What is the history of that song?
So that song I learned from some recordings made by Alan Lomax. And about 5 years ago, I went to
We should just let everybody know, Alan Lomax went around and recorded folk songs all over America, didn't
he? Yeah. So he went to Beaver Island in 1938 to make some recordings there. And I went to the Library of Congress about 5 years ago to listen to those. I'm so glad you can get them online now because I had to go to the Library of Congress and they have this big tape machine. And I like had my phone out recording on the headphones. And some of the recordings are really slow, so it was hard to get all of the lyrics. And I was really struck by this song partially because a lot of the songs I were hearing were Irish songs that I already knew, and I was kind of digging for something that I hadn't heard before. And I hadn't heard this before. It's a sea shanty, and it was sung by a man named Andrew Gallagher. And he said he'd learned it about 45 years previous from what he called a saltwater sailor. And he said it was a really popular sea shanty with the sailors on the Great Lakes. And there are some tweaks in the words you can tell they made to fit the Great Lakes, like the phrase dark domestic sea, obviously not referring to the Atlantic Ocean.
Not indeed.
So, yeah, I was happy to find something that I hadn't heard before, you know, that had been around, but that the Beaver Islanders, or at least like the sailors of the Great Lakes, had kind of tailored to make their own.
And refresh our collective memory about the close ties between Ireland and Beaver Island.
Well, there were a few settlements before the Irish came, but the Irish came in the middle, about the middle of the 19th century, and it was primarily settled by residents from Erin Moore, an island off the west coast of Donegal. And one of the things that really attracted me to it was that they spoke Irish Gaelic there till the 1930s. In particular, I was really, really, really hoping to find something in Irish. There's another song on the album called Leaving Erin Moore, and that's actually a translation. I even emailed the Beaver Island Historical Society, and they put something in their paper seeing if anybody could dig up the Irish version of that song, and they couldn't, unfortunately. But I still was able to find a lot of really beautiful songs. There's a lot of great fiddle music from there as well. And so even when you go there today, there's a real... Well, first of all, there's Irish flags everywhere. There's shamrocks. And one thing that struck me was, I think when I was there, there was two pubs that were open, and they felt very much like Irish pubs. You walk in, everybody wants to know your name. They want to know why you're there. They want to strike up conversations.
And have you sing a song.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. With that in mind, let's take a listen to this beautiful song, Leaving Erin Moore.
Oh, beautiful earth, the land of my birth. It's with sadness I leave you behind, but I hope and I pray that on some future day I will return to my kind.
Well, you have this album release party coming up at the Gaelic League on Michigan Avenue, right in the heart of Corktown in Detroit. And so, as we mentioned, that's going to be on July the 28th.
Mm-hmm.
How about any other performances coming up?
Right now, that's about it. I'm lucky that there are some great Irish musicians in the area, and I haven't been, you know, like in a band or a group in quite a while, so I've been piecing this recording together for a number of years using the local musicians and using a few friends from out of town, a few friends that came in town, and then I kind of just asked to help record something on there. But now having this collection, you know, I'd really love to do more with it and have something a little bit more regular.
Well, how can fans of Irish music and fans of Beaver Island find your new CD?
They can go to katieelse.com, and there's a music section, and if you click on that, you can listen to the whole thing, and it'll give you lots of options to buy it as well.
Katie Else, her accompanist that you've heard today is Bob Mervak, and the new CD is Songs from Across the Lake and Sea. Good job. Wonderful singing, wonderful songs, and thanks for sharing your love of this music with us.
Thank you for having me.
This coming Saturday, thousands and thousands of fans will pack Michigan Stadium for a rousing game of football. No, not the Jim Harbaugh, Michigan Wolverines kind of football. This game pits two superstar English teams, Manchester United versus Liverpool, the Red Devils against the Reds. Here in the U.S., we call it soccer, but to the rest of the world, it's football or the beautiful game. Gary France grew up on the northwest coast of England and then moved to Michigan. That move did not dim his love for his team, Manchester United. He writes about his quest to stay connected to Man U from this side of the pond in his memoir, Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of United. Gary France, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me, Cindy. It's lovely to be here.
So, Manchester United versus Liverpool. How big and how old is this rivalry?
It doesn't get much bigger. There's a matter of probably, gosh, 35, 40 miles between the two towns, cities, if you like. You're talking a rivalry that probably goes back something like, I would say, 140 years at least.
Well, when you think that Liverpool, I looked it up, founded in 1892, Man U in 1878. And so this has deep roots.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So would you say an American equivalent, what would it be? Michigan, Ohio State, Michigan, Michigan State, Red Wings, Avalanche?
I think you're looking at all of those. I mean, Michigan, Michigan State, for sure, in the same state, close together. Mm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
When and how did you discover Man United? Because you didn't grow up in Manchester.
No, I grew up in a little village called Hesketh Bank, which was about 30 miles from Manchester, okay, in the northwest of England. And I loved football. I always had a soccer ball, if you like, at my feet from an early age. And my father loved his football. He actually had a trial for a local team, a professional team called Bury. He loved his soccer. And we were very fickle as kids, you know, bouncing from one team to another. And United became my team probably around 1975. And I mentioned this in the book. Mm-hmm. I just totally began to become totally attached to this team that was reinventing itself. It was a great side of the past. It was the first English team to win the European Cup in 1968. And it was just kind of that era, that team. And it was very, very exciting football. We weren't able, and we didn't have the liberty of watching so many live games like we do here. Ironically, we can watch so many on a weekend morning here. I had a radio. I had my father's enthusiasm and the odd highlight reel at night. And I was just starting to hear about this United team just bringing themselves back to the big time. And it was around that era when they got I think in the book, it's April the 4th, 1975, I believe, Lou Macari scores a goal and it sends them back into the promised land, into Division One. And it was from that day on, I just became besotted with this team. And they were just so much fun to watch, exciting, attacking football.
And you came to Michigan what year?
I came to Michigan 95. In the book, I take some literary license, say around 1995. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so internet was still a kind of a new thing, no satellite TV. What'd you have to do to follow your team here?
You do anything you can to remain connected to this love that you are besotted with, right? So at first it was 2-week-old newspapers from the little professor in Dearborn. I was living my support in retro, Cindy. Mm-hmm. I was just grasping any straw I could. I found a shortwave radio, BBC World Service, on a Saturday morning here. You got the second half commentary of a game. And it was so surreal because it would fade in and out. It would, you know, the reception was poor, but you're grasping onto any nettle you can. Yeah. I developed a transatlantic phone line with my father. And he would give me reports of the games afterwards, using a calling card, I may add. So anything you could do. I was even at one stage sending home dictaphone tapes, and my father would tape some of the shows on the TV and interviews, pop it in the post, get it back. And 2 weeks later, I'm there listening to this on a little dictaphone from my day job, so I could at least keep up with all the reports. It was another world.
When you stop and think that support for, air quotes, soccer has grown here to the U.S. to the point where top teams from all over the world are justifying coming here, playing in this International Champions Cup. Did you ever imagine the day that Manchester United and Liverpool would be virtually right here in your backyard at the big house?
Absolutely unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. You know, and stepping into Conor O'Neill's in the mid-90s, no way. There was no way on earth I would ever have imagined, particularly the big house steeped in football history.
And we should let everyone know who isn't familiar with Ann Arbor, Conor O'Neill's is an Irish pub right on the main street, and they do carry satellite games. And So just to prepare anyone who might be seeing these two teams for the first time Saturday at the big house. So if you're a Liverpool supporter, sorry there, Gary, you can pretend you're at their home stadium at Anfield, and here is what you'd be singing. Gary's dying here. You'll Never Walk Alone is really the Liverpool anthem. Do we know why?
I've just left the building.
Well, now for Gary and the other Man U fans, you can pretend you're not at the big house in Ann Arbor, but rather Old Trafford in Manchester, and you're singing your heart out. Feel free to sing.
And the Reds go marching on, on, on.
Beautiful.
What should fans expect to see on Saturday?
Hopefully a great game of football. It is preseason. They've got to bring that into account. To see some of these stars. And it's tough, Cindy, this year because it's a World Cup year. Mm-hmm. So
a lot of them have been playing and they're worn out.
You got it. You got it. But there will be passion on display with a capital P, you know, between these two sets of supporters, even the American affiliations. The amount of American supporters groups that I see flying around the internet in all states for the United and for Liverpool. And obviously the likes of Sirius Satellite Radio mm-hmm. with Charlie Stilettano, who's arranging the whole tournament. It's just incredible for Charlie to put all this together. And I think the spectacle of seeing this many supporters for an English soccer game in one place. I was actually at the Real Madrid United game 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. It blew me away. The amount of passion and the amount of support in that stadium. So it'll just be a fantastic afternoon.
And for an Englishman to see these two together, it doesn't get any better,
absolutely.
I take it. And you're part of some pregame fun Friday night?
Thank you for bringing that up. Yes, very kindly, Nicholas Books have offered us a slot to do a book reading for my new book, Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of United. So I'm thoroughly looking forward to that.
Gary France, thank you so much for sharing your love of Man United with us.
Cindy, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Coming up, we continue looking back at the rebellion that took place 51 years ago this week in Grand Rapids and how it's shaped the city today. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This week marks the 51st anniversary of the 1967 rebellions in Michigan. While the one that lit up Detroit was the biggest and the deadly one, Grand Rapids faced a similar event, 3 days of unrest that left 44 people hurt and 350 arrested. Well, in honor of the anniversary, Michigan Radio's Bryce Huffman visited the area near Delaware Street Southeast and South Division Avenue, where the trouble in Grand Rapids began. And he asked people walking by if they think the city has changed in the past 51 years, and if so, how?
Yes, it has changed. You know, we got jobs, houses and stuff. You know, we got decent houses and all that stuff. It changed a lot.
You know, there is work here. It's just a lot of racism. For instance, me and this white guy started working together. I'm doing a really good job. This guy is coming in late or whatever. Don't know what the heck he's doing. After 2 months, they made him the manager.
There wasn't a lot of mixed races growing up, and definitely is more mixed now. Things are definitely more accepted, not as much ignorance, you know?
Well, I think that we have a lot of subtle racism that goes on here, and I think that because of the day and age that we're in now, that there are more things being brought to the table, and it feels like some of the younger people who actually have taken some of the time to maybe get to know all the stories and to do a little research, that they want to fight also for equality.
Those comments from Jeffrey Dean, Tony Davis, Jolie Walcott, and Regina Davis. To continue exploring just how Grand Rapids has changed in the past 51 years, we now welcome Ellen James, who's a leader in the city's African-American community, and Tavian Moore, president of the Greater Grand Rapids NAACP Youth Council. Ellen James, tell us briefly just what was Grand Rapids like in 1967? What was the Black community having to deal with?
Well, first of all, it was segregated. And looking back and thinking back on it now, I'm not sure I realized how segregated it was. And there were just certain places that you did not live. All of the Blacks, majority of the Blacks, were in one section of town. And that was where we were all kind of, you know, segregated in those particular areas. And that was because realtors would not sell houses to people of color.
And were there any people of color in leadership roles in the city at all?
There were just very, very few. We had no people of color on our city commission. There were very few police officers. There was no representation on our school boards. Most of the business was not African-Americans, Blacks were not involved in. We were not sitting at the table while the decisions were being made. And that certainly was very detrimental.
And Tavian, I could tell from your voice, you were not around in 51 years ago.
I was not, no.
As you hear Ellen describe that life as a person of color 51 years ago in Grand Rapids, what comes to your mind? What do you think of?
For a while, there was a struggle for me personally to connect that time period to time periods today. But I also think that there are a lot of things that overlap. One of those being, we in high school, my senior year, we were in class and we were having conversations about driving through East Grand Rapids. And our teacher who lives in East Grand Rapids had made a comment that her husband and her noticed that whenever people get pulled over, they're usually people of color. And I bring that point up to say that there are still areas in our city where that environment or that culture still exists. Mm. And I bring that up to say that we have made a lot of progress as a country, as a city, but there's still a lot more progress to be made when there's still portions of our city or areas in which minorities go, and it's still not common, and it makes other people uncomfortable.
Between that situation and as you learn about the uprisings and what happened 51 years ago, is that what kind of inspired you to get involved with the NAACP and other local grassroots efforts?
Sometimes I don't feel inspiration. Sometimes I feel like it's an obligation. I think that there were so many people before me that fought for me to even be in the position that I'm in, to be able to sit down with community leaders like the mayor, the chief of police, and have difficult conversations. There were so many people who laid that foundation for me to have a platform. And I feel like I would be remiss of my obligations to not stand up and to not take on a strong leadership and be a community advocate. I do feel a sense of inspiration from Ms. James. She serves on the adult branch, Grand Rapids NAACP, as first vice president. And just hearing these stories and them pouring into the younger generation and really teaching us how to step up and be leaders, that's where I find inspiration specifically.
And Ellen, I know you've really poured your life's work into making Grand Rapids a better place. And I also know you were a recipient of the 2018 Giant Among Giants Award. What motivated you? What did you want to accomplish by being such a part of so many boards and groups that were shaping Grand Rapids?
Because I felt that it was a very, very important when decisions were being made, and these were decisions about our lives, that I needed to be at the table to have some input. Because sometimes people make decisions because they don't know better, and then sometimes people make decisions because they do know better. The one thing that I always tried to do was to make sure the minority perspective was put on the table. And I also wanted to bring other people with me. This was not a selfish journey because I always wanted, you know, bring somebody else, let somebody else be here.
And when you look, Ms. James, when you look at this new generation of activists in Grand Rapids Black community, like Tavian Moore sitting there with you, what do you think? Do you feel like the torch is being passed on and in capable hands?
I think the torch is being passed on in very capable hands. One of the things that the young people that I'm working with, particularly with the NAACP, is the fact that young people like Tavian, they don't know everything. So a lot of times I bring history to the table. There's a lot of things that I, you know, have already been through, that people my age have already been through in this community. So we don't have to reinvent the wheel. So I think it's a good combination of working together. I'm really encouraged that Grand Rapids has a number of young people who are starting out, and they are stepping up to the plate, becoming a part of the city, a part of the community that will make an even greater contribution than a number of us have made.
Tavian, given that the Youth Council works in such close partnership with the chapter's general membership, I wonder what are some of the lessons that you have learned from elders like Ms. James and others as it relates to organizing, to working with city officials, and creating sustainable change, something that is really going to make a difference?
I would say one of the biggest lessons and something that they really try to instill in me before I knew it myself is that now is the time for change and now is the time to step up and become a leader. So we're not the leaders of the future, we're the leaders of the present. We're experiencing things as young people that aren't hitting us 10, 15, 20 years from now, but they're hitting us now and they've hit us in the past.
I want to wrap up with a question for both of you. I'm wondering, what is your outlook for the future of Grand Rapids and whether you think the city is moving in the right direction?
I would say we've made so many important strides, even in the past year. Anna C. Hodges, 11 years old, she was leaving her back door with her family, and the police had responded to a call about an alleged incident where someone had a knife. And they pulled guns on Honesty and had her walk backwards towards the police. She was screaming and crying, asking them not to arrest her, and they placed her in handcuffs. And it was just a very traumatizing experience. And I, as an 18-year-old, I couldn't even imagine being held at gunpoint mm-hmm. by the police, mm-hmm. Let alone an 11-year-old girl. So when we have issues like that happening in our city, we really need to take a step back and ask ourselves, who are we and what can we do? Everybody, and this isn't just community leaders, but what can we do as a city to make sure things like this isn't happening? And I think that us bringing the issue to light and us going to the city commission and saying we need to develop some sort of policy to protect children and make sure that they're not being held at gunpoint, that is moving in the right direction.
And being heard when you brought your concerns.
Especially being heard. And I think that they heard us loud and clear. We sent a very strong message. And they created a policy, the city did, called the Honesty Policy. Yes. To where they started to add a youth scenario to police training. So looking at how they're dealing with youth in stressful situations. Now, I do not think that that has solved the issue, mm-hmm. and we've been very vocal about taking that a step farther. But I think that it is definitely a step in the right direction.
And Ellen James, is Grand Rapids moving in the right direction?
I think Grand Rapids is moving in the right direction because I think that we are demanding that Grand Rapids move in the right direction. We cannot afford to sit back and just let it happen. We have to be active participants in mm-hmm. making it happen. But if there's an issue that you're concerned about, don't sit home and say, well, this is going on, that's going on. I always encourage people to be a part of the solution. So unless we speak up, we would not have the rights that we have today. And we have to continue to really say fight for those rights, because if you don't, people will forget and they will regress. So yes, I'm very optimistic about Grand Rapids. Is Grand Rapids everything I want it to be? Absolutely not. But Grand Rapids is a whole lot better than it used to be because we as a group of people have demanded better.
Ellen James and Tavian Moore, it was a pleasure to talk with you. We want to thank you for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It is arguably one of the cutest, most memorable TV commercials ever made.
My baloney has a first name. It's O-S-C-A-R. My baloney has a second name. It's M-A-Y-E-R. Oh, I love to eat it every day. And if you ask me why, I'll say, 'cause Oscar Mayer has a way with B-L-O-G-N-A.
And that commercial is warming baby boomer hearts right now. And it tees up our look at unusual festivals in Michigan. The Yale Baloney Festival is celebrating 30 years this month. It draws thousands to the Thumb to celebrate lunch meat. And here to talk baloney is event coordinator Barbie Stasek. Barbie, first off, pronunciation, Bologna or baloney?
Baloney. That's how we say it in Yale.
All right. Well, and it's your festival. How did this event get started?
Well, way back in the 1980s, Michigan celebrated a sesquicentennial. And so we had a wonderful time here in Yale and decided we needed to keep some sort of a party going. So the Chamber of Commerce members got together and wanted to talk about what we were famous for, and that is our amazing Yale bologna.
And so give me the history of Yale bologna.
Well, Yale Baloney dates back to the early 1800s, actually. We're a area that was pretty much founded by German and Polish immigrants. And when they came here, they brought their homemade recipes for bologna. And we still, to this day, have our own bologna manufacturer, and that is C. Roy, who provides our festival with 2 tons of homemade Yale bologna.
Stop. 2 tons. That's a lot of bologna.
That's a lot of bologna.
So tell us what kinds of things happen at the festival, particularly some of the bologna-centric events.
Well, we do have our very own Yale Chamber of Commerce bologna tent. And under the bologna big top, you can have the best fried bologna sandwiches you've ever had besides what Mama used to make. And it just brings back some wonderful memories for those of us who grew up on fried bologna sandwiches. And we have bologna on a stick, bologna hot dogs, and celebrating our small town heritage, we even have outhouse races.
In fact, I looked at your Facebook page, and I also went to yalechamber.com, and I see pictures of the outhouse race, the little crescent moon on the design on the door. It's pretty priceless.
It's very, very specific. We even have to have a Sears catalog in it to make it right.
Now, tell me about the king and queen of bologna.
Yes, our wonderful royalty. We have our king and queen of bologna, and don't forget our prince and princess hot dog. And for 30 years, these people have run for the royal race and to wear the crown. They raise the money at a penny a vote, and the biggest money maker wins. But actually, we all win because the money they raise goes back into funding our festival and making sure it's free for everyone to enjoy, which is very, very important to us.
So you want come one, come all, and you want it just to be fun without having to be dipping into people's pockets.
Absolutely. This is one of the last true family festivals where you can come and have fun, see art, see entertainment, see your family, see your friends, and see the very best of what small town America is. Of course, we'd love it if you bought a fried bologna sandwich, but you can enjoy it anyway and just come down and do it for free.
Now, I have to ask, what is the royal garb? What do the king and queen of bologna wear, and what's the crown look like?
Well, the crown actually does have bologna on it. Of course, it's not a real ring, but we do make sure that our royalty have the red and blue capes, and they have their crowns and their tiaras, and they're some of the most popular people all weekend. They sign autographs and meet with people, and they're our biggest welcoming committee.
Now, I understand, a little birdie told me, that this festival is kind of very personally important for you.
Well, it sure is. I've been involved since the very first one. This is my 30th year as well. And my husband and I are co-chairmen of the event. And we are both old has-beens. We're both old king and queens. And we've put a lot of time and effort into making this great for everyone that comes to visit.
And how many people tend to come? How many people make their way to the Thumb and to St. Clair County to salute bologna?
Well, it's kind of amazing because we're a town of around 1,900. Out of those 1,900 people, we have almost 1,000 volunteers, and we host nearly 30,000 visitors.
That is great. In the middle of July, or the end of July, I should say, in the Thumb, it doesn't get prettier than that.
It's a beautiful place. And through the whole entire weekend, it's just jam-packed full of fun for everyone, from history buffs to tongue-in-cheek bologna fun, to carnival rides, to fried bologna sandwiches, magicians, clowns. It's just an amazing time. And we're going to have one of the biggest, best fireworks in the entire state. We're very proud of that. So come join us.
Well, you can find all kinds of information on the Yale Bologna Festival by going to their Facebook page, or you can go to yalechamber.com. All the details are there. What do you like to put on your fried bologna sandwich, Barbie Stasek?
Well, my favorite is a little bit of sauerkraut, onions, and mustard, and it doesn't get any better than that.
Barbie Stasek is the event coordinator for the Yale Bologna Festival. Thank you so much for sharing your love of bologna with us.
Thank you so much. Come to Yale and see what the best of small town America is. We're here waiting for you. And that's no bologna.
And if that fried bologna sandwich sounds as good to you as it does to all of us, the Yale Bologna Festival takes place today through Sunday. And that's stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening to us.